I'm Michael McMullen. Welcome once again to the WPBSA official podcast, where this week we're focusing on a tournament which I think people of a certain age will recall as one of the most famous of all world championships. It was 1982. The man who won it, Alex Higgins, has of course long since departed. But I think other than Alex, probably the player who's most remembered for that fortnight in 82 is Tony Knowles, who pulled off one of the most remarkable crucible upsets of all time. And I'm delighted to say Tony is with us. Tony, great to have you along. Could I just ask you briefly, what's the first thing that comes into your head when someone says 1982 World Championship?
Obviously, nice to be here, but and see you both. What comes up is everybody knows that Alex Higgins won that year. And it was, he hadn't won the championship for 10 years. So it was a bit of a remarkable achievement. And obviously a well-received one as well.
And what about you, John Skilbeck? You're the writer of Goody Two Shoes, which is a wonderful book all about the 1982 World Championship. And it's great to have you as well. So you're the world's leading authority on that fortnight over 40 years ago. What's the first thing that comes into your head now, having written that book, when people mention that championship?
Oh, good question, Michael. Probably 5 years of toil in putting this book together. it's been sort of a joy looking back at this one tournament and going really deep on it, finding all the interesting characters. There's obviously Higgins at the centre of it, but there are loads of really interesting characters from... There's sort of a clash of generations in this tournament, which I find fascinating. It also came at a really interesting time in sort of in UK history, with quite a lot going on outside the Crucible walls, which I find quite fascinating as well, seeing sort of the culture as well. But then obviously there's Tony's result, which kicked it off in style, and then there's the grandstand finish as well, with Alex winning and the baby and etc. So I just think it's the greatest world championship there's ever been.
Well, we'll talk about all that and so much more. And Tony, let's talk about your career and where you were at in 1982. I think one of the big myths about your win over Steve Davis is that it was your Crucible debut, but it wasn't, of course. You'd played there the year before and very nearly pulled off an upset then, which would have taken you through to play the defending champion in 81.
Yeah, I think I played, was it Roy Andrew Arthur?
Well, mate, to qualify, but when you got to the Crucible, it was Graham Miles that you played in the first round.
Yeah, Graham Miles, that's right, yeah. Well, what had happened to me is I actually applied to become a professional in 79, in late 79, and the entries had to be in for the 1980 World Champ. There was only two actual tournaments that I could play in as a professional, which was the UK Championship and the World Championship. And what happened is they refused me my entry after not losing a match that year as an amateur. So... what happened is I lost out in playing any tournaments on this amateur circuit and professional circuit for about over 12 months. So when I came to play in my match against Graham Miles and I was a bit out of touch. I was a better player, I think, in 79 than I was in 1980, 81. But it took me 2 years to actually sort of find my feet again. And I did that, obviously, with the confidence came back once I'd beaten Steve Davis at the Crucible. Yeah, and that opened a lot of doors there.
Yeah, and we'll certainly come to the detail of that match. So you'd been to the Crucible in 81, and then we were into the following season. And John, at that time, that was the era when the circuit was really evolving from, as Tony says, just a couple of tournaments into a lot more opportunity. That 81-82 season leading up to the Crucible, John, had really been dominated by two players, Steve Davis and Terry Griffiths.
Well, yeah, this was it. I mean, and by the time you came to Sheffield time, no one was really looking at anyone other than those two. Because as you say, Steve had been, you know, probably number one, but Terry wasn't far behind him that season. I mean, what a player Terry was back in the late 70s, early 80s, sometimes gets forgotten. So by the time Sheffield came around, you know, Alex Higgins was a 25-1 shot, which was partly reflective of where he was with his game, but also, you know, Davis was 5-2 on to win that tournament. So, and Griffiths would have been second favourite at fairly short odds as well. And then, If those two went, it was a pretty open field from what I can see. And obviously that's how it turned out, Michael.
Just thinking, Tony, just to go back to that, I think the Andrew Arthur match, that was in the UK. I don't think that was in the World Championship.
Oh, right.
Yeah. But you'd qualified anyway then, again, in 1982. And I think it was different in those days, Tony. I think you knew when you were qualifying who you were going to be playing if you got through. And in your case, it was Steve Davis. And he went in as a massive favourite to win the match. But it was clear early on that he was struggling.
Well, what happened there, I was pretty confident at the time. I was playing well. And the World Championships actually didn't start on the Saturday afternoon as it does
That's
now.
Right.
It started on the Friday night. And I actually, I went into an 8-1 lead, I think, on the first night. And I only needed two frames the following morning. Of course, I obviously spent the night in the town having a few drinks and up fresh. And we played at 10:30 in the morning them days. So it was a pretty early start and I won the first two frames.
And that is the story that's always gone round, Tony, that after that session you went out and you only had a few hours sleep. So it sounds like that story is absolutely true.
Yeah, too right. Yeah, we went out, we was 8-1 in front, and I was relaxing. We went to Josephine's nightclub for a few drinks, and we was in there till after 2 o'clock, and up the next morning, I was fresh and won the first two frames.
And of course, the match had been on television that night. As you say, it was the start of the championship. So were there people coming up to you in Josephine's and saying, oh, you're the guy who's 8-1 up on Steve Davis?
Well, in them days, it was really busy all over Sheffield, outside the stage door, all over the streets. You know, it was a new thing in Sheffield. Obviously, it had only been played there since 79 when Terry Griffiths came from an amateur and won through and first time and won the title.
So when you won it, you got the couple of frames you needed quite early on. You were through 10-1. And back in those days, it's impossible, Tony, isn't it, to describe to anyone who wasn't around what a huge star Steve Davis was. So for you to beat him in the first round, the media reaction and the extent to which your profile rocketed must have been huge.
It was going from from obscure to sort of being front page news on the main news on the TV. And all the press wanting to get photographs and headlines in the paper.
And John, that really set the tone, didn't it, for the early days of that 82 championship? Because as far as the top seeds and the pre-championship favourites were concerned, that first round was really an unparalleled bloodbath.
Yeah, once he actually lost a couple of frames, he couldn't. I know what it's like because it's happened to me. But once you lose a couple of frames and you try and gather your thoughts and get your game together, it goes worse, and he just couldn't get going. And I kept the pressure on all the way through that match. I didn't take any chances. It wasn't an ice break. There was no eye breaks in the match, and it was pretty much tight safety play. And I took every chance that he gave me. So yeah. He had a tough time getting going, basically.
Yeah, I think it was only three breaks over 40, but that was all that you needed to do. So, John, over to you then. Tell us about some of the other extraordinary stories there were in terms of big names getting beaten in those first few days.
The three previous world champions, aren't you? You've got Davis going, obviously. We've spoken about that. Griffiths going to Willie Thorne. Willie Thorne, sort of a real coming man at that time. He really fancied it that year, especially once the draw opened up. And a young Jimmy White, who turned 20 at the start of that championship, just demolishing Thorburn, 10-4. So that was sort of Jimmy probably announcing himself to quite a lot of viewers at the time that he was obviously a real coming player as well. And once Davis, Griffiths and Thorburn, you know, the three respective world champions of the previous years, as I say, go, it's anyone's game, isn't it? Which is phenomenal. I mean, Tony will have fancied it. Alex will have fancied it. Willie, John Virgo, these great, great players of the day, all through to the second round, really liked their chances from there on.
Yeah, you talk about the recent champions before that. Indeed, the next new world champion that there was to be a few years later, Dennis Taylor, he also went out in the first round to Silvino Francisco. So it was four of the top five, John, had been beaten in the first round. But it was also a round that threw up a lot of quirky incidents. And one of those involved another Taylor, David, in a match against Patsy Fagan. And something that I guess was always going to happen at some point in snooker's history. And this is the match where it did happen.
He took a great big lash at the cue ball before it was
Patsy did, that is.
Up in the pocket. Patsy Fagan did, absolutely. Patsy took a great big lash at the cue ball before he was about to drop in the pocket. It was a moment of frustration towards the end of that match. It was a tight match. And I guess he just briefly lost his head, you know. It was one of these really weird moments in snooker. And it was followed by confusion over whether that was him conceding the frame or not. I think David Taylor maybe thought it was, but Patsy said it wasn't. Referee Jim Thorpe at the time, he was the man trying to make head or tail of this. He shuffled the balls around to a position he thought was correct. After that, he started moving all the balls around the table, which was... I'm not quite sure if that was in the rule book at the time, but it looked a little bit odd. And I actually did a little bit of research on this, Michael, while I was writing the book. It didn't make the cut for the book because you can only fit so much in a book. But I found Jim Thorpe, who was quoted in the next day's papers. He said, I'll quote him here. He said, "I asked Fagan if he was conceding the frame and he said no. Fagan apologised profusely and David Taylor said nothing. He made no complaints. Fagan told me to replace the balls where I liked. I knew the green was on the yellow spot, but I didn't know where the blue was. It never entered my head to award the frame to David Taylor, and I think all the other referees would have made the same decision as me." So obviously this was before we had the opportunity for referees to go and look at a screen to see where the ball should go back. So he was trying to do it off memory and probably didn't guess it quite right. I also asked Patsy about the incident when I was speaking to him for the book. And you know, I think he was probably a bit embarrassed by it at the time, but what he told me was, and again, and I'll quote him, he said, "I just knocked the ball back out. I was going to go in off and you're supposed to let it go in the pocket, but worse things have happened, believe me."
I'm not sure that's quite how it happened. I'm not sure that's quite how I remember it, the way he played it. But anyway, a remarkable thing to happen. And great, by the way, to get something that didn't even make the book. This is like the bonus content now we're getting for Goody Two Shoes.
Oh, you're getting the good stuff, yeah.
But there was also something else that happened in that first round that had never happened before. People think that the first time ever there was behind closed door snooker at the Crucible was 2020 in the midst of the COVID crisis. But not so, because it happened in 82.
Now, this also involved Fred Davis and Dean Reynolds, didn't it, Michael? Funny odd incident. I mean, I'm not entirely sure of all the background to this, but they obviously couldn't quite get finished in time, so they had to go and just spot in another frame in the arena by when everyone else had gone home, which is obviously a very unique situation, as you say, until 38 years later when we got nearly a whole tournament of this.
Yeah, I think the scenario was they'd only managed to play seven frames in the first session. So they'd obviously fallen a couple behind. And then in order to catch up a bit before they went out to play again, they were just basically sent into an empty arena to play one frame, which Fred Davis won to level the match, although Reynolds actually won in the end. But Tony, we've seen so many first round giant killers over the years, and probably the majority of the biggest and most well-known end up then losing in the next round. But that certainly wasn't what happened to you. You comfortably beat Graham Miles, who, as we said, had knocked you out the year before. And suddenly you're in the quarterfinals of the World Championship, playing the very experienced Australian Eddie Charlton. And it was a match you so nearly won.
I was thinking about seven or eight frames in front of Eddie Charlton. And I just got one of them blocked. And Eddie just came back at me. And I thought I froze. I didn't know what to do. I was in that position whereby I'd lost control of my game, and he beat me. But I should have beat him hands down, actually, Eddie Charlton. I think it was just being in that position at that particular time early on in my career. But going back to what you said earlier about one of the best matches there when you were talking about the lads who were still in. Jimmy White could have actually won that year in 82. He should have won that tournament, the World Championships. And it wasn't, it was only that Alex had made the best break of his life at the Crucible, one that's renowned and still showed today. 59 break when he had to come back and beat him.
Yeah, and we'll get on to that because that obviously is probably the most famous moment of the championship, that clearance from Alex Higgins. But when you had that quarterfinal against Eddie Charlton, Tony, you were only two frames away from getting through to the semis. As we've discussed, most of the pre-championship favourites had gone out. So had there come a point along the way where you had started to feel that you might be able to do something similar to what Terry had done 3 years earlier and come through as a surprise winner?
Absolutely. He was just taking each match in its stride. But he got one of them positions whereby the closer to the winning line you got, the more pressure he was actually putting on you. And when Eddie started to come back at me, I probably panicked. You know, I probably didn't know how to deal with it at that particular time, you know.
And John, Eddie Charlton was someone who'd been around for a long time. He'd been close to winning the championship before.
He was a crafty player and he knew his way around the table and he knew what to do. But I don't particularly think he beat me on sort of merit. I think it was more that I lost the match than he won it.
Yeah, as we say, you were in a very strong position, Tony, 11-6 up, and then Eddie Charlton came back to win. And John, just returning to you, with all those big names going out, knowing Eddie Charlton's personality and the certain level of confidence that he had, he must have been starting to feel that this was going to be his time and he was going to be Australia's first ever world snooker champion, John.
Well, we had to wait a while, didn't we? For Eddie. What a terrific run he had. Unfortunately, it came at Tony's expense, that quarterfinal win. But, I mean, you know, that showed that even, I think, at that time, Eddie was 52. So he'd have been a real vintage world champion as well in terms of his age. But he was playing well. But, you know, there's one man we haven't spoken about so far, and that's Ray Reardon. And that's the guy that he would come up against in the semi-finals. And, you know, Ray was of a similar vintage. I think Ray was 49 at the time. But Ray was, you know, still probably more widely considered a threat for the title than Eddie was. And, you know, even though that semi-final was nip and tuck nearly all the way, the forgotten semi-final, of course, Ray had a little bit too much in the locker at the end for Eddie. But yeah, I mean, you know, Eddie, really classic room.
I think Ray was more of an all-round class player at that particular time. He'd won it six times before. And, you know, he just knew what he was doing, Ray. He knew all the shots. He was a very, you know, you could learn a lot from Ray Reardon.
Yeah, Charlton actually led that semi-final, as you alluded to there, John, by 3-0. They were level going into the last session, 11-11, and then Reardon pulled away to win 16-11. But Tony, we have this debate all the time about who's the greatest of all time, and I think most people now agree Ronnie O'Sullivan has that category sewn up at this stage. But back in those days, was Ray Reardon regarded as the greatest player we'd ever seen up to that
point? Well, in that 70s and early 80s era, late 60s, early 80s, I would say Ray Reardon was the best player at that particular time. He had a more all-round game was... I think the person probably who followed on from that would have been Terry Griffiths. But but for me then, the person that now has got who has had the best all-round game is John Higgins.
Yeah, well, he's certainly brought all the departments to bear. But let's talk then about the other semi-final, Alex Higgins against Jimmy White. And John, I'll come to you for this because I'm actually going to say the unsayable here. I think that 69 break, excellent moments in it, great recovery shots along the way. I think it's been a bit mythologized over the years. And I think you actually look at it, once it gets to about 20, it's actually quite plain sailing. And People say he cleared up from an impossible position, but you actually look at the balls as he came to the table, it wasn't like that. So, John, are you with me? Or are you going to try to convince me otherwise?
There's some truth in what you say there, for sure, Michael. I mean, I think it is a fabulous break. But as you say, it's those first sort of six or seven balls, which is what everybody remembers. It's a total break of two halves. You know, there's some wild shot in that. Everyone remembers the blue. It was a really long black. There was the delicate cut on the red. There's all sorts of really memorable shots within that. I think by the point he got to around 19, he'd pulled off most of the shots of the tournament in that break. And from then on, he had the table pretty much at his mercy. It was fairly simple from there on. He just had to keep his head, though, because one miss and he was out, wasn't he? So it's still a real sort of measure of his focus in that moment that you can really appreciate, even if some of the pots in the latter half of the break weren't half as spectacular as the earlier ones.
Yeah. Jimmy, of course, had a chance to win frame and match there. And as I recall, he played a really awful positional shot. And you have to wonder how different the course of snooker history might have been had he actually managed to stay at the table for another couple of balls. But then Alex won the decider quite comfortably. And so he's through to the final to play Ray Reardon, two guys who have both won the championship before. And Tony, as a player of that era, I'd be interested in getting your perspective on this. People would say that was the ultimate clash of styles, that Reardon, as you say, had the all-round game and Alex was all about attack. But I think Alex's tactical game has often been greatly underrated, and he was actually very strong in that department.
I've played with Alex Higgins in the billiard hall since I was 16, when he first came over from Ireland. It was a lad who used to look after me, a guy called Jim Worsley, a grade A referee at the time, who actually brought him over from Ireland to play as an amateur in an international match at Bolton TC. And from there on, he actually came back and then lived with him for 3 months. And I went on the circuit playing exhibitions and matches all over Lancashire with him when he won his first world title. And I played with him all over Lancashire for a good few years. And I learned most of my game as a youngster from Alex Higgins in the billiard hall, as you're playing and you're practicing with somebody, and you learn the skill side of the game. Now, using in them days, we were using old balls for starting out with Bronzoline, then Crystallate, then Super Crystallate, and the game got easier over and over. And basically that became the demise of Alex Higgins eventually, because he could no longer sort of compete with the new style that you needed to play the sport. But in them days he could play every single shot. He knew all the tricks of the table, and tactically he was a great player.
So he was in the final, Tony, sorry, as we say, against Ray Reardon. Huge television audience for it, as there always was for the world final in those days. But we know a lot of people, once they go out of the championship, they say that they don't watch any more after it. So can you remember, would you have continued to watch the championship on TV after you went home, having been knocked out?
I watched most of that match. And two different styles, but you know, Ray won it six times, and Ray was a controlling figure, a very dominant figure around the table. And he sort of control of the table, but Alex just probably overpowered him with, because he had a lot more skill.
Tony, I was just going to say to John, what are your recollections of that final? Because as I remember it, it was a match that swung one way and the other, and it was very difficult to call throughout until Alex Higgins put on a great burst towards the end, John.
Yeah, Ray obviously went ahead early on in the match. Alex took the overnight lead. And as you say, it was really nip and tuck from there. I think Alex was 15-12 ahead. Ray came back at him, back to 15-all. Ray thought he might have him at that point. I mean, it wasn't to be. Alex had sort of a final little surge in him, obviously finished off in grand style with that 135 in the final frame. It it was a very good final, wasn't it? It maybe wasn't the absolute classic, because everyone remembers the Jimmy match an awful lot more than that one. But yeah, the moments after the final, of course, which is what that final is remembered even more for.
Well, we're so used to seeing that now, aren't we? Players having their families, their children, in all sports, come out and enjoy the moment of celebration with them. But back in 1982, it was actually quite a new thing for something like that to happen. And Tony, I think maybe, and you'll know, having known Alex, how relevant this is, I think for a lot of people, the reason that resonated so much was the fact that everyone knew Alex's life off the table was really turbulent. And it was as if on the table, everything had come together for him. And as a result of that, he enjoyed a rare moment of tranquility in terms of his off-table personal life.
Of course, it's the BBC catching the emotional side of the event, basically, of him finally winning the world title and catching the emotion of that person.
I don't know how true it is, by the way, but I have heard since that him and his wife ended up having a big row later that night and she to bed. Yeah. But one thing I do know happened, and John, you probably came across this when you were researching the book, is that the very next day after the final, Alex was up before a WPBSA hearing because of some of the many unsavoury things that had happened in the months prior to that.
Yeah, he certainly was, and his trouble sort of piled up really during the World Championship as well. He was caught by a Crucible official. I can't quite remember how Silvino Francisco phrased it. Tiddling in the flower pot, something along those lines, I think was how Silvino
I was wondering how you'd get around that.
Yeah, I think that was the way that Silvino kindly put it. I think Silvino had practiced a little bit with Alex during that tournament, so he was quite aware of what was going on there. So he got in trouble for that, and he also got into a scuffle with an electrician, damaged this electrician's jumper, ended up having to buy the electrician a new jumper. That there was talk during the tournament, mainly possibly in the local press, but this certainly wasn't a Sheffield Star. They were talking about Alex potentially being thrown out of the tournament at one point because of his behaviour. He obviously avoided that, but as you say, the next day he was his case.
I think he had difference of opinions with Paul Averill, who was the tournament director at the time.
Well, that came a few years later at the UK Championship. That was when he ended up getting the big ban and the big fine. But there were so many of those incidents. And Tony, I mean, you obviously spent a huge amount of time around the circuit in those days. I know there's a lot of affection still for Alex, but when he was in the wrong mood, he was not someone you wanted to be around at all.
Well, he was a troublesome person, really. He liked to create controversy. So if you said it were black, he would say it were white. You know, he was one of them people.
Yeah, the sort of light and shade of him, I think, is even reflected in what happened the next day, because apparently while the disciplinary panel were having their discussions as to what they should do in terms of a sanction, he sent a case of champagne in for them from his winnings from the night before. So it just shows both sides of him. But Tony, try to convey to us, if you could, just the scale of celebrity that top snooker stars like you had at that time, because 82, it really was coming into that era when the game's profile in Britain was at its absolute peak. And the stars, they were as big as any footballers, any pop stars around.
Well, one exhibition I did in Liverpool with Alex Higgins straight after the World Championship, where we opened a club in the centre of Liverpool and we couldn't get down the street. Anybody'd think the Beatles were arriving, you know. It was the whole street and the whole town was totally blocked off. We had to have the police actually get everybody back to get the car down to the venue.
But I'm guessing, Tony, from having, you know, grown up watching you back in the 80s, I sense you probably really enjoyed all that and that you weren't afraid of being in the limelight at all.
No, wasn't afraid. Obviously, it's annoying sometimes when you trying to go about your own business and you're getting stopped and whatever, but it's part and parcel of the job and what you have to put up with. But we did get a lot of adulation at the time in the early 80s.
One thing I was saying earlier, Tony, is that sometimes when you see players pull off these big upsets at the Crucible, they then go out in the next round. Another thing that often happens is that you never really hear much about them again. You think of Michael Wosley, who beat Ding, hasn't done anything since. James Cahill, who famously knocked out Ronnie O'Sullivan 5 years ago. He's still got time, of course, but hasn't really built on that. But with you, it went a completely different way, didn't it? Because you had that great run at the 82 World Championship, and you then went on and built on it and had a great couple of years to follow.
Yeah, I should have won it. I think I should have won the world title in the following year when I lost to Cliff Thorburn. That would have been my best year to win it. I then followed that up in 85, where I lost to Dennis Taylor semi-final. And 86, I lost in the semi-final to George Johnson. Both players who I was favourite to beat, and both players went on to win.
And you look at that 83 match, Tony, that was probably the best chance, wasn't it? Because you were 15, yeah, 13.
I was 1 foot in the final, yeah.
It was first to 16 then in the semis.
Yeah, I was 1 foot in the final. I missed a pink in the corner pocket to finish him off. And he came back and beat me.
And I think I'm right in saying, Tony, that each of those three semi-finals you lost, had you won them, you would have gone on to play Steve Davis in the final. So how would you fancy playing him over four sessions in a world final?
Well, I don't think that would have bothered me. I mean, all my life, I've actually, as an amateur, and I've always had a very close matches with Steve Davis, apart from one that was in the English, I think it was.
The final of Ipswich, I think.
I lost quite heavily to him. But other than that, I should have beat him at Pontins. It was when we were amateurs, where I lost 4-3 and I was in front. I should have beat him in the Lang Scottish Masters, where I was in front. And, and when he came up with, when Barry Earns sent him around the country and he played at my club when I was an amateur, he came with Jeff Foles to play me and Stan Aslam, and we beat them 8-0. So I've always had a good record with Steve, and he, obviously one of the greatest players of the 80s. Yeah.
I think what reflects, Tony, just how well you did in the years following that win over Steve is that a couple of years later, you were actually number two in the world rankings behind him. Did you feel at that stage that you actually were the man most likely to knock Steve off his perch and overtake him?
Well, I should have done. I should have actually gone on from that. But what happened was in 1984, just before the World Championships, the Sun decided to descend on me with an article which actually ran on the front page and across the board, 11 pages of the Sun newspaper on the, just before I was due to play, to do with the snooker and the sport, which just set me back a bit. And it took all my concentration and my natural game. I lost my natural game, and And when I played the semi-finals in 85, 86, I didn't particularly think I was actually playing that well. You know, I wasn't playing nowhere near as good as I was in 83. And, 84, if I'd won my first match, which was against John Parrott in 84, I would have been number one. So
you went pretty close. And John, just returning to you to come back actually to the earlier stages of the championship, we talked about what an eventful first round it was in 1982. There was also a landmark snooker moment, really, wasn't there? Because we've had so much snooker success from Scotland over the years, particularly at the Crucible with Stephen Hendry and his seven titles, John Higgins with his four, Graham Dott, the 2006 champion, Alan McManus, who's been in a couple of semi-finals. But it all began in 82, didn't it, John? Because that was when we had the first Scottish player ever at the Crucible.
Jim Donnelly, of course. Glasgow-based Jim Donnelly, who I spoke to for my book. He didn't land the easy draw, did he, unfortunately? He got reared in round one, which is going to be seriously tough for any rookie, obviously. You'd expect him to probably have Jim Donnelly's number, and it turned out that way, 10-5. But Jim knew Reardon a little bit, but before they played that year, I think Reardon came up quite often to Glasgow. Jim Donnelly was a resident professional at one of Reardon's clubs up there, so it said they knew each other quite well, and I think Jim quite enjoyed that experience. They also began one of their sessions at a time when Higgins was starting his campaign as well. So they're out there in that cramped corridor, and Jim was telling me a story of how Higgins was just agitated, couldn't stand still, even at that stage of the tournament. So he was also in the players' lounge as well when you were winning, Tony, against Davis. And Jim remembers that really clearly as a big moment. So although he didn't last terribly long in the tournament, so I think the first Scot to appear at the Crucible got quite a real feel for the place. Really sort of, you know, and obviously at that time in 1982, there were youngsters in Scotland watching, and I dare say, you know, John Higgins may well have been paying attention that day, or may become aware a year or two later that Jim Donnelly was sowing the seeds really for future Scottish dominance. Really, he was a very good player, still doing a lot of coaching, I think, certainly until recent years. Does a lot of fitness coaching as well. Very, very sort of, good guy, good snooker person. And obviously he was the first, but there were many to follow.
Yeah, and to his credit, actually, as you rightly say, it was 10-5 to Ray Reardon. But at one point he was just one behind at 6-5, and then Reardon actually pulled away and put in a big finish to win the match. But also, John, in the first round that year, something we've not seen very often, an all-Canadian match in round one. And John Baer from Canada made his appearance that year, lost in the first round to Bill Werbenick.
Yeah, John Baer, left-hander, said to be a phenomenally smooth player. Cliff Thorburn had known for many years.
It was a big fella, actually, John Baer. I remember, really, we went up, myself, Tony Mayo, Jimmy White, Steve Davis, went over to play in the Canadian National Championships in Toronto, and that's the first time I met Jim Baer, and he was really a pool player, but came over in the championships that year. Very, very good player.
And Tony, as we're coming towards the end of this now, obviously it's a long time ago, great to see you still going strong and still getting the cue in hand. You're playing in the World Seniors
on the 8th.
Yeah.
I'm playing the World Seniors on the 8th of May, straight after the World Championship. I played the Egyptian champion in the first round.
But in addition to that, you've also played in Q School a number of times in recent years. I went over to
Albania to actually play in the World Snooker Federation tournament. I got out of the actual the round robin stage, and then I lost in the knockout where I didn't play very well. But I played one or two events over the years. 2 years ago, I was at Q School, and I was only one match away from qualifying, which was my closest, and had some good results. But last year I didn't play that well. But I've put a lot more practice in this year. I seem to have more incentive to play now, you know. So for 20 years, I've not really had the incentive to play the game. So
the fact that you're still playing, Tony, after all this time, just shows how much you love the game.
Yeah, I've been putting a bit of practice in just recently for this match, so I'll see how I go in May, and then I'm just about to enter Q School this year. Give it one more go.
Well, so, there's always time for one more go. And John, you look back on that era, as you said at the start, it really was an extraordinary time in your country, in Britain, and I think there's nothing quite like sport for distracting people from their troubles. And I know in Britain it was a troubled time. Some people would say it was at war with itself for about 5 or 6 years before that. But while that 1982 World Championship was going on, John, Britain was, in every very real sense, quite literally at war.
Yes, absolutely. The Falklands War was going on at the time, and this was really sort of it's sort of the height of the Falklands War, really, was in 82, in the Crucible time in 82. We had the early on in the tournament, there was the sinking of the Belgrano, there was the sinking of HMS Sheffield. I mean, Sheffield, for goodness sake. I mean, the city was suddenly stunned by the ship that sort of bore its name going down. So during that tournament, although I've asked many people about it, it doesn't seem to have really been acknowledged totally much of the Crucible, as far as I'm aware, that incident. Because as we know, when it comes to Crucible time, it's all snooker once you get inside those breeze block walls. But outside the Crucible, there was a service at Sheffield Cathedral to mark the loss. I think there were 20 dead on HMS Sheffield that day when this Exocet missile struck it and sort of left it stricken. So it was very much in the news. But you know, as we know, whenever we go to Sheffield, nothing really seems to get in the way of the snooker, does it? As soon as you get into the Crucible, no one's talking about anything but the snooker.
Why do you think it was, Tony, that at that time in particular, the game just reached such a massive level of popularity in Britain?
Well, it basically started with showing the semi-finals in 79 when we lost sponsors. And talking about sponsors, the game just suddenly grew from 79 and it gained momentum every year till it peaked in 80, with the Steve Davis, Dennis Taylor. Obviously, nothing could beat that with 18 point something million viewers. But in that 82, we had a new sponsor came on board with the Jamesons Open, which I won in 82. Played at Derby, and they actually put more money into the event than was in the World Championships. In fact, they actually increased the prize money of the World Championships to actually the level of the Jameson Open.
And of course, none of that would have happened if the game hadn't been enormously popular at the time. So what do you think it was about the players and the game itself that just appealed so much to people and made you such superstars at that time?
I think basically all that is the success of actual BBC's coverage of live snooker. And even today now, the live... there's that many platforms now to show live sport. Sports is actually in all aspects of different sports, minority sports. They've all actually, you can watch them on TV live from your own armchair now without having to turn up at the venue and watch. And it's the same for every sport now. You can watch every game of football on TV. Today after I finish now, I'll be watching every game that's being played for the final judgment day of the Crucible.
Yeah, this is when we're recording it, as players are trying to get through to the Crucible and try to trying to create the sort of stories that you did back in 1982.
There's going to be 8 winners today from the Institutes of Sport that are going to play next week at the Crucible, yeah, and the start of another story.
And when you look back on your time, Tony, coming through qualifying, going to the Crucible, beating Steve Davis in the first round, getting all the headlines, I assume it's something you look back on with great fondness that you were part of it all.
Absolutely. When I look back, basically it was there at the real start of snooker, right from, you know, PSA, the WPBSA, you know, to it started really with when we played in Pot Black in the early days. And I was fortunate enough to actually be invited to play at Pot Black at the start of snooker on television.
Well, John, it was an extraordinary era, as we say, and we alluded earlier, I think it was you, Tony, mentioned the 1985 final, and I think for the wider public, that was probably the peak of it. But John, do you think it would be fair to say in conclusion that for hardcore snooker people, actually taking overall the 1982 championship was perhaps the peak of that extraordinary era.
Yeah, I certainly think so, Michael. As I mentioned earlier, I think there's a fascinating clash of generations. There were the people who had sort of come through the games as professionalism was dawning, but there were also those who had been inspired by watching those early days. You had your youngsters, as I say, the likes of Jimmy, that even Steve Davis was a youngster then. He was a terribly mature player, obviously, but he was very young. And they were chalk and cheese, and they appealed to different people, which helps. And you had so many interesting personalities, the likes of Jimmy, Doug Mountjoy. Look at the clothes he wore. He was great. He looked fantastic. I was even speaking to Stuart Bingham yesterday after he qualified, and I think he quite admires what some of these guys were. And Dominic Dale was saying the same. Dominic's quite an extrovert, isn't he? But I don't think he'd even dare wear what the likes of Mountjoy and Higgins would wear back in the day. And yeah, I think he was just a great tournament. I mean, there were so many fantastic matches in 1982 that we haven't even had time to talk about today. You know, Higgins beating Mountjoy 13-12 in the second round. It nearly all came undone in round two for Higgins. He nearly didn't make good on this pledge to his daughter. But then drama just sort of seems to seep through the tournament, doesn't it? Everywhere you look, there are phenomenal figures, really interesting people, great moments such as the 69 break, and then it all came to a head with the baby on the floor of the arena at the end. And just one more thing that I found out during the research for my book was that moment right at the end of the final almost never made it to television. There was a big sort of wrestling match behind the scenes between the executive producer and the presentation team back in London at the BBC. And one wanted the snooker to come off so that they could show the next programme. And there was Nick Hunter, the executive producer in Sheffield, who had to say, "I can see a baby. This is going to be the moment that everyone remembers this final, this tournament for. Give me another 45 seconds or so. Give me another minute. Let's get this moment live on television." And, you know, thank goodness he won the day that day, because that's one of the outstanding moments that we remember in British sport from the 1980s. I mean, what a champion Higgins was that year. He hadn't quite knocked the booze on the head, but he behaved himself reasonably by Alex Higgins standards. The couple of incidents that I mentioned earlier were very minor incidents, really. He was on quite good behaviour. Hence, Goody Two Shoes, the title of the book. It's also obviously coincided with the song of that name, which came out during that World Championship as well. But he was a phenomenal champion, and he was probably, you know, the peak of his sporting life, if not, you know, the peak of his life, really.
Well, I think it's fair to say he was controversial throughout his career, throughout his life, but there's also no denying the role he played in popularising snooker to the extent that we've talked about. And the peak for him, as you rightly say, John, was that incredible championship in 1982. Tony, you were a big star of it. Thanks so much for joining us. Goody Two Shoes, as we said, it's a wonderful read by John Skilbeck. So thanks so much to both of you for joining us. And thanks to everyone for listening. And we'll see you again very soon on the WPBSA official podcast. Bye-bye.